Hey Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A24 1521 Ellen Sue Loss Ewald et al. Petitioners respondents versus Nina Loss Ewald Nedrebo, appellant.
Okay. Well, good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. As you probably each know, you will have 15 minutes for your initial presentation, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There's a timer on the podium at the center, and feel free to adjust that before you get started. There's a button that moves that up and down. I'd ask you to each introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument as well as your clients, and that way we'll have that pronunciation information for our record because these proceedings are going to be recorded, and that recording will be available within 24 hours on the Judicial Branch website. With that, I wanted to know for your information as well that unfortunately Judge Bjorkman is unable to be here with us today, but she is observing these arguments via live stream. We can't hear any questions from her, but she is participating in the observing the arguments today. And I think we may also have some observers in the room. So welcome to all of you as well. With that, counsel for appellant, please feel free to adjust the podium and begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. John Gunderson. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Nina Nedrebo, and she's been referred to in the briefings as mother, so I may just refer to as mother to make it simple. So she is the mother of the minor child that's at issue in these proceedings. This case is really a fairly simple case. There's a simple set of undisputed facts. We're not arguing about facts in this case or whether the court, you know, abused discretion about deciding facts. We have a fairly easy set of facts. We also have some very simple, my belief is, statutory interpretation here. And we're asking the court to apply these simple facts to the straightforward language of the statute. I'm just going to recite a couple of the facts that are important just to emphasize for the court. My client, the mother, she has sole legal custody of the minor child. She has sole physical custody of the minor child. She has 100% of the parenting time of the minor child. The father does not have any legal rights. He's out of the picture. He does not have any parenting time. The only issue with regard to the grandparents is visitation, very much different than parenting time. And that was made clear in a prior decision by the court. So those couple of facts are very important, that mother has 100% legal, physical custody and parenting time of the minor child. That is not in dispute. It never has been in dispute. Also, there is no dispute that there has never been a finding that the child is in any way endangered or in harm or that she's not being taken care of by the mother. And in fact, the district court, after the trial, made a finding that there is no physical or emotional danger, no extraordinary circumstances which would justify interfering with the fundamental parent-child relationship. So there are no extraordinary circumstances. There's no need to engage in any questioning about the safety of the child or anything like that in this case. That's been determined. And that's contrary to suggestions throughout this case, including in this appeal, that somehow mother is unfit, or she's emotionally harming the child, or she's not a proper parent. There's nothing in the record that suggests that, nothing. So it's also undisputed that mother, with her child, moved to Massachusetts in June of 2022. So almost 3 years ago, she's gone from Minnesota. She has zero connection to the state of Minnesota other than this visitation order that's in place here. She lives in Massachusetts. She works there. She's going to school there. The child is there. Her teachers are there. Everything is taking place in Massachusetts. There is zero connection to Minnesota at this point. It's also undisputed that the grandparents initially tried to stop the mother from moving to Massachusetts. They filed a petition for sole legal and sole physical custody to take complete control of the minor child. That petition was denied in November of 2021. That case is over.
Does that have some legal bearing on this matter today?
That has been adjudicated. It is completely over. It does have a bearing, according to the grandparents' argument, that somehow there's this remaining right to some legal custody, some legal rights. That's not true. That decision was made and decided in 2021. It's final. It was never appealed. And there is no evidence in the record that the grandparents have any further rights at all to bring another motion for legal custody or physical custody in this case. That's been decided.
And they have not.
And they have not. And then after mother moved and the visitation order was granted, grandparents again tried to stop her from moving or to changing the visitation schedule to occur in Massachusetts. That motion was denied by the court. Then it was appealed. This court then ruled and affirmed the district court that mother had every right to move to Massachusetts. That's been adjudicated. That's a final decision.
So we're familiar with the factual and procedural history of the case.
Yes.
Should we talk about the UCCJEA and how we interpret the provision that's applicable here?
Absolutely. And the UCCJEA very clearly says that when the child and the parent and any person acting as a parent leaves Minnesota, that this state loses jurisdiction. The statute's pretty clear. It's very clear. And in fact, the district court didn't even address the operative provision of the statute, which says that when the parent and the child leave the state, that there's no jurisdiction. The district court talked about the first provision of the statute, which talks about a connection with Minnesota. I completely disagree with that analysis, but it doesn't even matter. The court just ignored the second part of the statute, which says that when the mother and the parent leaves, there's no more jurisdiction. So that brings us all the way now to the issue that the grandparents have argued under this unpublished Hay case, that somehow the grandparents have a claim to a right of legal custody, so therefore they can move their way into the statute and say that somehow they can prevent mother, they can allow jurisdiction to continue in Minnesota because somehow they have some parental rights of some kind. And bottom line, it really does hinge, their argument hinges on that Hay case. And I'll talk about that. Pretty obviously, it's an unpublished decision, so it has no precedential value. Number two, I think it's extremely important that if you read, again, if you read the Hay case again, the court goes to extraordinary lengths to go into all of these unique facts. They use the
It may
word
not have binding value, but it does have persuasive value potentially. So explain to
potentially.
us why it's not persuasive.
Potentially, I'm telling you why it's not persuasive. Exactly what I'm saying here is that the court in that case, I think, bent over backwards, as shown by all of the facts that the court cited. They went on and on and on in detail about the extraordinary circumstances, about the admissions by the other side that the other party was acting as a parent, about all of the proceedings in that case, and why, under those unique circumstances, that somehow that parent was still, that person was still acting as a parent. So if that course has that case has any value, it's very, very limited to the extraordinary and unique facts of that case. And of course, I'm going to be looking at the vigorous dissent by Judge Warkey in that case. That was a pretty extraordinary dissent because it went on for two or three pages where Judge Warkey was adamant that the court must focus on the relevant facts of the case as it pertains to jurisdiction. And the court must apply the plain language of the statute. And the plain language is that a party who could potentially be acting as a parent must have claims in the present to a right or a claim to custody. And as determined in the dissent in that case, Judge Warkey indicated that there were no claims. And as I started out when I talked about the facts of this case, there are no claims, especially in this case, of a claim to legal custody. There is no present claim to legal custody. I don't know how there possibly could be, again, because the petition for custody was denied by the court. That's final. There is no indication that there's any basis because of mother's treatment of the child or whatever that they can come back and make a claim for custody. And that just doesn't make sense because what that means is that for some hypothetical reason, some potential, you know, claim that's not out there, that somehow they have a claim to come back and make a claim for legal custody, and that somehow anchors the mother to the state of Minnesota, that just doesn't make sense, and it doesn't fit the facts of this case. There are no claims to legal custody, and that also goes back to...
Is there a factual dispute about whether or not the grandparents were continuing to act in a parental capacity?
There is no factual dispute about that. The only factual dispute that the grandparents have raised is that the first element about physical custody, they're claiming that there could be a factual dispute about whether they had some temporary physical custody of the child. And we don't even need to go there because the statute says and a claim for legal custody. So we don't need to get, I don't agree with that. That there was, they've never been awarded physical custody at any time by any court. But they claim that there's some question about whether they had physical custody at some point. Again, we don't need to go there because the statute clearly requires the legal custody piece, and there's no question about that. And there is no question then that they do not have a claim to legal custody other than 3 years ago, they petitioned again for legal custody, which was denied and has been completely adjudicated. So there can't possibly be a claim for legal custody in this case. And therefore, the court has to apply the plain language of the statute. And I'll also, as I mentioned in the brief, when you look at the commentary to the statute, and that's just commentary, I understand that, but it's published in the West version of the statute. It was quoted by Judge Warkey in his dissent. It was quoted in my brief. The official commentary to the statute from the committee that drafted the uniform law said, hey, when a grandparent or a third party has visitation, there's no more reason for any jurisdiction in that state. And the reason that comment is important is it's obvious, but it also ties in exactly with what the statute actually says. The comment doesn't really create anything new that's not obvious when you read the statute, but the comment's helpful because it obviously just clearly says, no, it's our decision when we wrote this law that if you have a grandparent or some visitation that's still out there, that is not a basis for jurisdiction, because that's not a parental right. And there's a distinction. And then that also ties in, especially in Minnesota, now that we've completely made the distinction between parenting time and visitation. There is no more dispute about that because the law has continuously been adjusted and evolved and corrected to point out the difference between visitation and parenting time. And that was the issue in the prior appeal in this case, where this court definitively said that there's a distinction between parenting time and visitation, and that's why the grandparents could not prevent the child from moving to Massachusetts. That's applicable here because we still need to be clear about the visitation, which is limited by the court order, which is contrary, very distinct from parenting time. And without parenting time, without any legal claim of custody, the grandparents have no basis to continue to assert jurisdiction in Minnesota over the child. And finally, the constitutional issues are paramount in this case. It's easy to overlook that, but it's extremely important to remind the court that there's no question that mother has a fundamental constitutional right to take care of her child, to move where she wants to move, to live where she wants to live, to take care of her child in that matter. That was recognized by the district court, the fundamental rights. It was recognized by the dissent in the Hay case. And that is especially important to keep in mind when construing a statute, that there are fundamental constitutional rights here, and the court must be extremely careful not to read ambiguity into a statute that might override the constitutional rights of the parent. I see my time is up for 15 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. So next we'll hear from counsel for the respondent. Again, feel free to take a moment to adjust the podium. The timer has been reset to 15 minutes, and please introduce yourself and your client when you begin. You may begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Gary Diebele, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents in this proceeding, Ellen Ewald and Terry McCallson. Your Honor, while I don't dispute counsel's argument that there's undisputed facts mostly in this case, I do think it's a very complicated fact pattern that led us to where we are today, and I'm not going to go into any of that. The court indicated you're aware of that. I think the most important thing from my perspective is to keep in mind that this was not your typical grandparent visitation order. It was a very robust order. I use that term throughout my briefing in this case. I have rarely seen a grandparent visitation order that was as extensive as this one. And again, the whole thing was premised at the time of the original trial of Ms. Nadribo being very well settled in a good place while she was here in Minnesota. And that whole thing was disrupted when she moved. And actually, the immediate proceeding that led to the appealable orders in this case here in Minnesota were actions taken by my clients to enforce, clarify, deal with the apparent violations of the visitation order that were still going on. As the record will indicate, Ms. Nadrebo has brought three actions in Massachusetts, trying to get the Massachusetts courts to step in and do things in this case. Same allegations that she was raising here in Minnesota, abuse allegations by the three grandparents. So nothing new was even raised. And all three of the judges in Massachusetts, it was different judges. She went to different courts as she moved from Western Massachusetts to Eastern Massachusetts, basically said, these allegations have been investigated time and time again. There's nothing to them. And furthermore, this case is in Minnesota, belongs in Minnesota, and it's staying in Minnesota unless you bring a motion to change the jurisdiction, and she tried to this last time, and it didn't happen. So in some sense, I think basically the argument is we're looking at trying to analyze the pretty narrow provisions of the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act. The most important one is 518D.202 that deals with the sort of central concept of the UCCJ of exclusive continuing jurisdiction, meaning that once a court of the state hears the matter, and as long as there's still a connection by the parties and one of the parties still lives here, that jurisdiction remains in the state, absent some pretty extraordinary circumstances.
Well, Mr. Diebele, it is correct, is it not, that the district court really relied on subpart 1 in its resolution here and did not speak to subpart 2.
I think that's probably true, and I think that that's sort of the analysis where I think most judges start with this is there still a connection here that makes sense?
Sure.
Is the evidence here, are the, you know, circumstances that we need to look at still here? And then that second part where you look at, is there still a party here? I mean, that's a little bit more complicated.
But doesn't it have to be considered in making a determination of jurisdiction, given that it's a, you know, it's a disjunctive structure to this statute?
Yes, I think that's probably true. And I think we argue that there is certainly the court, if she didn't specifically directly address that, I think there's still sufficient information before the court that would justify that determination. And, you know, we suggest that if there is going to be a remand, that would certainly be one issue, but we've tried to develop that argument here in the case.
But in order to, for this court to determine the need for a remand, we would have to be relying on the phrase, any person acting as a parent. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would say that's correct. And I'll get to that in my latter part of my argument as to how we think that can be supported by the record here. But if we look at, there's basically two primary arguments here. And we don't dispute this is de novo review. I mean, the factual basis, I guess, if there's underlying facts that support the argument, we'd have to do an abuse of discretion. But for the most part, it's de novo review. And I think the first issue that came out in appellant's brief was basically saying that UCCJA doesn't even apply because of the nature of the dispute. We argue that argument has been waived because Ms. Nadreva, when she was representing herself, never even raised that at the hearing on this matter. So we would say it could be, you could make a determination that part of the argument is forfeited. But even if you do decide to consider that, I think the law is pretty clear on that this case is either a child custody determination or a child custody proceeding. And I think it's critically important when you look at the language of Minnesota's version of the statute, it says visitation. And while Mr. Gunderson is wanting to say, well, we've changed the parentage statute in 518. We now use parenting time instead of visitation. Well, that part of the UCCJA was never changed. And in fact, the Hay decision, which we think is on all fours, and that's the thing that I think, yes, it's a non-precedential decision, but the analysis of the Court of Appeals in that case has been used in other jurisdictions, and we cite to other cases where the same analysis is adopted. And then after this case, it's cited. Michigan and West Virginia have adopted it, the same analysis. And so this is nothing unusual. And I think it sort of is counterintuitive to think that there are a lot of third-party visitation actions that go on with interstate components. It can be grandparents, it can be aunts, uncles, an unrelated third party. And in those cases, they're given visitation rights rather than parenting time. But the UCCJ clearly seems to pick up all of that. Anything related to the custody, the access, the visitation of a child is covered under the statute. And so we think it's pretty clear that there is no basis to this claim that the statute doesn't apply at all because of the nature of the dispute. And so that piece of the argument, I think, is pretty simple. If we focus then on the...
Yeah, for a second.
Yep, go ahead.
Mr. Gunderson made the argument that the prior decision from this court established that this is not parenting time, this is visitation. You disagree with that?
I do disagree. I think you have to keep that case limited to what the issue was on the case, and that was a relocation issue, which is extremely different from what we're dealing with here. I strongly disagree with where the court landed on that case, because it's sort of staggering to me that you wouldn't apply the same relocation doctrine, whether it's a third party or a parent dispute. I mean, the impact is the same. But I don't think that case is controlling in any way on this. I mean, that case, in some sense, that case basically said, we're not going to apply the notions of 518. We're going to simply look to the 257C third party statute, which deals with custody and visitation. And I think now the sense is he wants to now apply some concepts from 518 that he didn't want to apply before. So I think we're being a little bit inconsistent, I think, in how we look at the interplay between 518 and 257C. But I think my main point is that relocation is a completely different concept. And so I don't see that case as having any bearing on this case. I think the Hay case is really instructive, because if you look at how that case, the facts of that case are nearly identical to the facts of this case, but for the it was a former partner who was involved in parenting that child as opposed to a grandparent. But in both of those cases, the partner in Hay, the grandparents in this case, were extensively involved as parent-like figures. They were not parents. And so clearly we don't talk about parenting time in either of those cases. But they had very strong relationships with the subject child. And both of the third parties in the two cases were dramatically impacted by a relocation to another state. They were dramatically impacted by the efforts of the parent in both of those cases to eliminate or substantially reduce the involvement and role of the third party. And the same similar arguments were raised in that case. As I, she was allowed to move. I think there may have been a relocation challenge in that one too, although not directly similar to this one. But she was allowed to move, and then the issue became, what's how are we going to carry out the visitation?
So well, the way I remember the facts of Hay, it's been a little bit since I've read it, but I mean the mother of the child moved without. I mean it was sort of in the dark of night type thing. She had not gone through the steps here.
That's what we had in this case too.
Here you had.
I mean, she moved without getting any authorization. And you know, basically we found out about it after the fact. So I think the cases are remarkably similar. And in fact, unfortunately, the litigation history has been similar. They were in court all the time on that one. And we have been in this one too, because the mother still does not accept this visitation arrangement. I mean, we've had three actions my clients have had to hire lawyers for in Massachusetts to deal with the same old allegations of abuse that happened 10 years ago to herself. And now she claims they're happening with the child. So it's been frustrating that it's still going on. But I do think, you know, to get to the Hay analysis on how we look at it, this case, you know, one of the factors I think that you were talking about is there a person with physical custody or legal custody left behind? And basically what Hay said and what we have here is it doesn't mean that you had to have been granted legal or physical custody. It means that you had to have a colorable claim to have made that. And at no time was our motion for custody in this case dismissed, you know, by a pretrial, our motion, a Rule 12 motion or anything like that. We had a 5-day trial on it. And as I alluded to at the beginning, basically the court said, these grandparents are integrally involved in this kid's life. I mean, they got her out of child protection in Norway. They've been raising her while mom was in school and mom dealing with her mental health issues. And so, if you look at, you know, whether the judge, you know, articulated that analysis or not, I think the facts of this case that are undisputed clearly indicate that we can survive challenge under both of those prongs, because fact of the matter is this child has 3 weeks of visitation here in Minnesota every year. My clients are going out to Massachusetts every third weekend. There's a 24-hour right of first refusal, and all of the evidence that mother has cited in all of the proceedings comes out of Minnesota. We've rarely seen any information come into any of her pleadings regarding how the child's doing in school in Massachusetts, medical issues. I don't know if any of them are in therapy. We haven't seen therapy records, anything. And this motion that we were before the court that led last summer was basically, we were trying to clarify the visitation schedule, how the 4th of July would work. 4th of July comes in the middle of the 3-week time, and she refused to allow, she made the child come back and forth for a 1-day visit. So we wanted to get that clarified, which we did. There were disputes about she would never provide school information. We had to struggle to get a calendar together. And it was just ongoing issues like that. And so I think this case, when you look at how Hay analyzed it, it basically said, as long as there was a colorable claim for custody, and as long as this child had an extensive relationship with the parents, like an parent-like relationship, a custodial relationship during the 6 months of the prior year prior to filing, then you've got a basis to continue to keep jurisdiction here. And in this case, Judge Conley, who was the first of the three judges, made findings about how extensive the relationship was. In fact, he found that the child had lived with them for 12 months, which is what is required for grandparent visitation. So even more than the UCCJA requirement. So I think under both of those prongs, Your Honors, they're clearly the trial court judge was correct in making a determination that this is still the proper jurisdiction for this case. There is still all of the requirements under UCCJA to keep continuing exclusive jurisdiction here in Minnesota. And the Massachusetts judges that have heard this now three times have agreed. They said,
and go. You're saying in this that there is a current colorable claim for custody?
I don't think it has to be current. I think the way that statute is designed is you look back to at the time the court exercised original jurisdiction, was there a basis for it?
Right. And so then that just remains in effect.
Yeah, I think yes, because I think the whole public policy underlying the UCCJA is As long as there's some colorable basis for the case originally starting there and there's still some connection there, we don't want what mother is trying to do in this case and what the biological mother and he tried to do, which is I don't like what the Minnesota court's doing to me on this. I want to move this to a new place. They said as long as there's still some basis there, the case stays there. You know, if my clients had moved out of Minnesota, we'd have no discussion. We wouldn't have any claim to be here. But my clients are still here, and we're still having to try to enforce this order here. And the Massachusetts courts are still sending it back here and said, deal with it in Minnesota. So I think it's pretty clear, you know, under all of those prongs leading up to it, and then also the idea that there's still a factual basis to have the case here. I do want to just talk briefly about this comment that Mr. Gunderson is relying on, the UCCJA comment. First of all, that has no legal authority, less, I would argue, than a non-precedential case that can be at least analyzed for and persuasive for analytical reasons. But I think as I read that thing more, that comment more carefully, I think it was kind of misconstrued by Judge Werke, not intentionally, but I think what that was designed for is cases where the family, the parents of the child have moved, and there are grandparents or other third parties that are still left behind that may have had a relationship with that child, that's not going to be a basis without having a prior order. Here, you've got a prior order, and you had a prior order in the Hague case that was directly obtained by the third party that they're seeking to enforce. This is not some new action where a third party says, well, wait a minute, we've got a close relationship, we're relatives, we think there's a jurisdictional basis. It doesn't work that way. When the parents are gone and the child's gone, that's that. But again, that comment is not binding authority anywhere. In fact, I'm not even sure the draft when Minnesota enacted the UCCJA that it paid a lot of attention to those comments.
So, counsel, I have a question. We're getting close to your time here, but was the fact that, well, the argument that you're presenting to us here today that they are people who are acting as a parent, was that presented to the district court? Was it preserved or was it somehow waived or forfeited?
Are you talking about the last hearing or throughout the proceeding?
Well, I suppose the last hearing.
I don't remember, Judge Wheelock, that there was a lot of specific discussion about that. I think, as I recall from that hearing and from the judge's comments at the hearing, she was more focused just on the general notion of exclusive continuing jurisdiction. As long as the parties are here and there's still a connection to Minnesota, I don't think we got into all the niceties about whether they were physical custodians or not. But again, I think it's fairly obvious that, at least if you look at the way the Hague Court analyzed it, the majority there, we simply look at, was there a colorable claim at the time they brought their action that they could request and make the claim for physical and legal custody? And again, that was never dismissed, you know, as a preliminary matter, a summary judgment type motion. It was after a 5-day trial. And it was after the court concluded that, well, mom's in a good place right now because she's got all her supports here. She's got a job, the kids in school. This is not the time. Maybe she's got lots of issues. I mean, we spent a lot of time at that trial talking about her mental health history. But the court said, as of right now, things are great. So I'm not going to disturb that. But we are going to keep the grandparents involved. You know, the trial court judge got a little upset when I kept referring to it as a safety net, the right of 24 hours. You see, this order didn't say anything about a safety net. Well, that is, I will still stand by that. That's in effect what Judge Conley was trying to do with this case. And they're still trying to do. That's what the judges are still trying to do with this robust visitation arrangement, keeping family members involved to see what's going on because of this long, complicated history. Did I answer your question, Judge Wheelock?
Yes, thank you. Do you have any other questions?
No, I mean, I don't know if you can necessarily draw the same conclusion. I mean, clearly these grandparents love this grandchild.
Oh, yeah.
They want to have the time. So I don't know if it's, you know, for protection or not, there may be an element. But
yeah, I don't know.
I'm sure they view it as the more contact the better.
Right. Yeah, and you know, and I will highlight that I've never seen a 24-hour right of first refusal in a third-party custody case. That was unusual, and that partly was why I've come to this thing that this was a very robust order. And I think I have to assume that was based on, you know, the circumstances of the case, but I don't know, and I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
We ask that the court affirm the trial court level. That's our ask today. Thanks.
Okay. And we will now turn back to counsel for appellant for the last word. There are 5 minutes on the clock. You can adjust the podium and begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, this appeal doesn't involve any kind of a modification of that robust grandparent visitation order. It's going to be in place, but it's important where those proceedings occur because, again, The mother lives halfway across the country in Massachusetts. So the jurisdiction of Minnesota just doesn't exist anymore. I want to just point to the trial court's decision when the court denied the petitioner's motion for sole legal and sole physical custody. The trial court was asked about the mother moving to Massachusetts because she told the grandparents she was moving, and that's why they filed the petition. That was no secret. The trial judge said, I'm not going to opine on whether mother or whether the minor child should be able to move to Massachusetts or not. I don't feel like that's my role in this case. So from the very beginning, there was no secret about mother wanting to move to Massachusetts. She didn't steal away in the middle of the night or anything like that. So the trial court knew about it. Then again, grandparents repeatedly tried to stop her from moving. And here we are, where we still now have jurisdiction in Minnesota. And it's hard to imagine how that can take place. The court
so, counsel, asked, I think the key issue here is whether or not the grandparents actually fit within the definition of a person acting as a parent.
Correct.
One of those aspects was the physical custody. Opposing counsel said in response to Judge Halbert's question that we should look back at whether the custody claim was colorable at the time that that decision was made. Are you in agreement with that?
No, not at all. That does not fit with the plain language of the statute. Claims a right to legal custody. So number one, the plain language of the statute, as pointed out by Judge Warkey, of course, in her dissent, says claims a right to legal custody in the present tense. The court must apply the statute as written, cannot find ambiguity where none exists, cannot apply that statute, especially in the context of the constitutional rights of the parent. And in addition, I just lost my thought. I was going to make another point on that. Yes, the colorable claim, again, that doesn't make sense for the court to make a ruling that somehow, somewhere in the universe, there is somehow this, quote, colorable claim for a right to legal custody. Where is that claim? There is no claim. The petition was filed after a multiple day trial. The petition was denied. The trial court said, I'm not going to make a ruling on whether mother can leave. Then the grandparents attempted to prevent the mother from leaving. This court said she could leave. The district court didn't even address that issue. It's very clear that the district court ignored the second part of the statute. I don't know why, but the decision itself seems a bit flippant, if I may, without disrespecting the court. It only says, well, there's a connection here, and the grandparents are here, and the kid comes to Minnesota. That has nothing to do with the language of the statute that says there must be a legal parent and a connection to Minnesota. So the trial court never even addressed that issue. And now this court, that's a legal issue, purely a legal issue. There's no factual question to that at all. I think it's a purely statutory construction under the undisputed facts of this case. The court should apply the plain language of the statute. So it doesn't matter what the district court did. The court obviously disregarded it. This court must apply the plain language of the statute, again, to the current circumstances about any claim of legal right. Yes.
As I recall the record, the mother brought the motion to dismiss the day before the hearing.
She was, number one, she was unrepresented at that hearing. She's gone through like five attorneys in the district court. I'm now representing her in the district court. So my understanding is she brought a verbal motion to dismiss at the district court, at the hearing. Okay. My time is up. Did I answer your question, Your Honor? Thank you.
Well, Okay, thank you so much. Thank you to both counsel for your argument here today. It's been very helpful, as well as the briefing. And the case is submitted, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.